The promise of paradise has a deep pull upon us. We want a perfect world, the idea of how things ought to be. Just think of TV programs for toddlers. Those of you a bit older will remember things like the Teletubbies, or more recently, In the Night Garden. Think of the setting of those. They are set in a safe, happy, green garden. Somewhere nice. Somewhere a little bit closer to paradise. Nothing to spoil. And as adults, we're actually the same. We love the dream of paradise. And we think, well, how can we get that paradise? I know what, maybe we could build a new town. We could make it just as we want it. It can be made in the light of the modern world. We can have the right transport, the environmental impact. I know what, let's make a garden city. Maybe we could create somewhere that is a new civic community connected by modern public transport systems, offering a diverse range of opportunities to live, work and play for people of all ages, backgrounds and incomes. Somewhere well-designed and with well-served neighbourhoods, workplaces, schools and town centres to ensure that residents enjoy a high quality of life with easy access to everything they need for healthy and successful lives. Wow. Well, of course, that's a quote from the Ebbsfleet Development Corporation. That's their vision. And we laugh because we know, actually, it isn't perfect. So what's the problem? Is it that our vision needs to be a bit bigger? You know, maybe Ebbsfleet or somewhere like that could be perfect. The problem is actually the other towns nearby. That's spoiling our dreams of paradise. Or maybe the problem is the other countries. You know, that they're messing up our future. Or maybe it's all those unenlightened people of the past who've messed up our planet, all the environmental damage they've left us with. I know what we need is a new start. What if in it? Imagine starting again on a new planet with all the right people with you. Well, of course, people have been plenty of films, haven't there, that have explored that possibility. But you know what? You don't need to imagine. It's already been tried. And you can read about it in Genesis 6 to 9. You read about a world that was in a terrible mess before the flood, out of control, and that world was destroyed. That old world was destroyed. And so Noah and his family step out on a planet that's had a total makeover. It's a new world. There's new continents. There's a new climate. There's new diet. And best of all, you've got rid of all the bad people. Because we think that's the answer, don't we? You know, how do we improve the neighbourhood? Get rid of the bad people. Maybe in your life you think, you know, my life would be so much happier, so much more successful if ... wasn't here. We think, let's get rid of the bad people. We'll get back to paradise. Well, it's been tried. So let's have a look. What's happened? Is it a return to Eden? Well, it looks a little bit like it, doesn't it? Chapter 9 begins with God blessing Noah and his sons, saying, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Blessing, that means life. They're going to increase in number. This is a reiteration of what God said at the beginning of creation. Noah is like a second Adam. And remember what was said about him in chapter 5. He was someone that was going to bring comfort, relief from the cursed ground. And then we see that Noah is like Adam, a farmer, a gardener. And he's producing fruit, wine, something to enjoy, something good. We're back to Eden. Well, yes, we are back to Eden, but we're back to it in the wrong way as well. We're back to the sin of Eden. Because just as fruit was the occasion of sin in Genesis chapter 3, so it is here with Noah's sin. And like Genesis chapter 3, Adam was left feeling ashamed of his nakedness. So is Noah here. This flood world is not a paradise. God knows that. That's why, right from the beginning of chapter 9, he's giving these laws to limit the damage that sin will cause. He anticipates murder in this new world. And the ground is still cursed. So actually, it's not so encouraging when we read in verse 20 that Noah was a man of the soil, or literally the ground. Actually, that's where some bad things can come from. And Noah himself is someone inherently sinful. What does God say at the end of the flood in chapter 8, verse 21? He says about people, every inclination of their heart is evil from childhood. Still the same. That included Noah. That's why Noah needed grace. And it's because of that, in the hands of a sinner, what is good can be misused to do bad. So the good wine led to drunkenness, not because there's a problem with wine, that's a good gift of God, the problem is in Noah. So don't blame other people. The reason you can't get to paradise is not other people, it's you. The songwriter Keith Green once said, you can get out of the world, but you can't get the world out of you. Think about homeschooling. Whatever reasons there might be for homeschooling, it certainly isn't an answer to the inherent sinfulness of your child. You see, your child can be a bad influence on others as well. Sin is still there. And just notice what the sin is here. Because there's a slight contrast, I think, to what's going on in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis 3, Adam and Eve were trying to overreach. They were trying to reach up to be greater than they were. They were trying to be like gods, whereas they'd be made as the image of God. They were trying to reach too high. Noah was almost doing the opposite. He was underreaching. He was being something less than he was. In a funny sort of way, Noah wasn't being like God in the way that he should have been. Noah was meant to be someone that would rule over the world, take responsibility. But he ends up being mastered, not even by an animal, but by a plant. That's the terrible thing about drunkenness, is that it actually dehumanizes us. It stops us taking responsibility. In a funny sort of way, it actually brings us more down to the level of animals. Which is why we should never joke about getting drunk. Too many Christians make jokes about these sort of things. We shouldn't. It devalues our humanity. And just beware of that sin of underreach. We miss it. But it's where we can stay as children, in effect. Where we spend our lives playing games, sometimes literally, sometimes just in the other ways that we avoid responsibility. We end up being lazy, avoiding responsibility, not living up to this great calling God has given us to rule over the world that he has made. And we end up being mastered by the world. Beware of the sin of underreach. But God understands all of that, and he's very realistic. He's making it very clear there is no way back to Eden. God is realistic about the dangers of sin in our world. So when people sometimes say, well, you know, we should get rid of our inhibitions. We should be comfortable in our bodies. You know, what's the problem with nakedness? Well, actually, public nudity doesn't mark a return to Eden. It doesn't mark a return to innocence. It's actually something very degrading and dehumanizing. Just think of what's happened in concentration camps. It dehumanizes us. Or people talk about the environment, talk about agriculture, and want to get back to some sort of paradise. Well, we're not in a paradise. We're in a fallen world. We're in a world of disease and disaster, and we need to be realistic about that. And in the church, sin is here. I mean, look here, the church here was 8 people, Noah and his family. Noah, you couldn't have a sort of more model Christian, could you? But he sins. Sin is still there in the church. So we do need financial safeguards. We do need to protect children. We do still need a place for privacy. I was reading an article recently about sort of the issues of data protection and sort of privacy and openness in the church, and it was sort of arguing, well, actually, as God's people, we shouldn't be so concerned about all this privacy stuff. You know, we should be ready to be open with one another. And there's an element of truth in that. But there are big dangers too. Even something like, you know, we should confess sin. Well, you know what? Confessing sin can be a great way to incite further sin if we're not very careful. There's dangers. We need to be realistic about the sinfulness that is still present. Yes, still in the church. So how are we going to survive if there's all these dangers? What's the answer? Well, the answer is grace. That's what chapter 9 is all about. God has promised this great era of grace. Remember what we did quite a few weeks ago now. This great era of grace that we're in, where God is keeping judgment at bay. That's what grace means. Sin deserves God's judgment. We deserve another flood, but because of God's grace, he's holding that judgment at bay. So that's the sort of scene that God has set in the first half of the chapter. And then from verse 20 onwards, we find almost a worked example of grace in a real family situation. It's a real worked example. And it's saying almost this is how you apply grace. This is what grace needs to look like in this fallen world. And on the one hand, it seems, you know, so weird, doesn't it? You know, what is Ham's sin? Why is it such a big deal? Why is it that Canaan is cursed, not Ham? All these questions. But God is getting us to stop and to think, because there's big lessons for us here in how we deal with sin. And it actually takes it, what seems like a sort of obscure story that you'd almost want to skip over is almost slightly embarrassing, actually takes us to the absolute heart of the message of the Bible. It's here for a reason. And I've sweated over this in trying to try and understand what's going on, but I think there's a wonderful message here. And let's begin, if you like, with the problem. Because, you know, how do we respond to sin? Well, we can have what I'm calling a ham-fisted response to sin. Now, this is a pun. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist this. Ham-fisted literally means lacking grace, lacking skill, sort of clumsy in a physical sense. So a different way we use the word grace. So, but I'm here just using that idea of grace and saying Ham is someone that didn't understand grace in the biblical sense, in the spiritual sense of God forgiving sin. How do I get to that? Well, the clue is to read the text. And we're told that in verse 23 that Ham saw his father's nakedness. Now, just as in English, there are an awful lot of sexual euphemisms in Hebrew. So uncovering nakedness can refer to sexual acts. And so lots of commentators here start speculating that something else must have really been going on here than Ham simply seeing. But Genesis isn't shy of being pretty explicit. I mean, just think of the situation in chapter 19 with Lot. It's almost an identical situation. And we're told clearly there incest is going on. So I think if that was what was happening, it would tell us. The other clue is looking at Shem and Japheth's actions, because their actions in covering Noah seem to be a solution to the problem. So that would seem to suggest that the problem was the simple fact of Noah being uncovered. You know, if their actions solve it, then the problem must have been the uncovering of Noah. And we're told something else too. We're told that Ham told his two brothers. Why doesn't he just cover up Noah himself? Why does he tell them? What's going on? Well, there is a sin of disrespect to parents going on here. And that is a very serious issue in the Bible. But so often there's a sin behind the sin. It's very often what are sort of small acts on the surface, almost impulsive acts or sometimes lack of action, that reveal what's really going on in our hearts. So often it's the casual word that shows what people truly think. Just like in Genesis 3, actually, you know, it's a what's the big deal about taking some fruit? The outward act was trivial, but it represented a heart of rebellion against God. And I think here, Ham's action or lack of action reflects a ham-fisted heart, a heart lacking grace. And you could understand this in two ways. You could say that Ham is going to his brothers and saying, well, I can do whatever I like. I'm going to copy Noah. You know, if that great man Noah can behave like this, I can do as I like. It obviously doesn't matter how we live, so I might as well indulge myself and enjoy whatever pleasures or whatever things bring me pleasure. That's how Calvin reads what's going on here. But I have a slight problem with that, is that why does Ham tell his brothers if that's what he's thinking? Because he clearly wasn't expecting their approval. You know, if that's what he was saying, he couldn't really expect approval from his brothers. I think it makes more sense to see Ham as opposing grace in a different way. That Ham is, if you like, the first Pharisee. And almost here, the beginning of, you know, the world after the flood, the first two sins are drunkenness and self-righteousness put before us. How do I say that? Well, I think Ham is here condemning Noah. He's saying, I'm not like Noah. And in a strange way, it's sort of delighting in sin. He's almost delighting in Noah's sin because it makes him look better. Look at what Dad's done here. Isn't it awful? Of course, I would never do that. I'm better than that. I think Ham here is acting as sort of the moral guardian of the universe. Ham is sort of the rescuer. He's going to expose evil where he sees it. You know, we're not going to tolerate that here, are we? He's a Pharisee. And yes, you can have Pharisees in the church. But as we saw last time, increasingly you have Pharisees in the secular world outside. We're in a very moralistic society where people say, you know, certain behaviour, certain language, that's unacceptable. Which, of course, is a convenient way of saying, I'm better than that person. I wouldn't fall into that. And there's a big irony there because that's exactly what racism is, isn't it? It's saying, I'm better than someone else. Think what we did with the children's talk. Well, actually, this moralism is exactly the same root as racism. So I think Ham here is opposing God's grace by being this moralist, this self-righteous person. But in a way, whichever interpretation you take, I'm not sure it matters too much. They are two sides of the same coin. These two opposite responses to sin. They're closer than we think because they're both using the sin of others to benefit me. They both sort of delight in sin. And actually, one can quickly slip into the other. I don't think it's any surprise that the sexual license of the 1960s has fathered the sexual moralism of today. I think one actually naturally leads to the other. And it can work the other way around as well. On my shelf, I have some good books by a minister talking about the importance of God's law, how we should live. And the problem is, he's speaking what is right. But he himself, even while he was writing those books, was engaged in multiple affairs. He didn't understand grace. He could speak what was true, and this is the danger of it. You can speak what is true and not understand grace. And I think that's a little bit like Ham here. To understand, we need to actually look at Shem and Japheth, because here we see God's grace displayed that covers sin. And it's seen in the actions of Shem and Japheth. And the account is written very carefully. We're told in great detail what they did. We're given very little detail of what Noah did or what Ham did, which I think is just giving us a little message that sin is boring. Okay, we forget that. Sin is boring. Don't waste time talking about sin. It's far more interesting to talk about grace, covering sin. And unlike Ham, Shem and Japheth did something. The great mark of a Pharisee is that they will talk passionately about all these evils they see, but they will not lift a finger to do anything about them. Lots of people like that today will wax lyrical about all these terrible things people say and do, but won't actually do anything about it. Shem and Japheth are ready to do something, and actually do something rather difficult. I mean, just imagine the scene. It's actually rather difficult what they're doing here. Walking backwards into a tent without sort of treading on Noah, without looking at Noah, trying to preserve their father's dignity. It's a pretty awkward act. And notice that they're not ignoring sin. They're not saying, well, of course, Noah would never do this. They're covering it, literally. Think of this analogy. If you've got a chip pan fire, the worst thing to do is to spray water at it, because the fire just spreads. Well, that's often what we do with sin. The more attention you give to sin, the more you just spread it. What you need is a fire blanket to damp it down. And that's what they're doing here with sin. They're literally covering it with this sort of sin fire blanket. Why did they act like this? Well, I think it's because they themselves understood God's grace. They had experienced God's grace. They had been rescued from the judgment of the flood. They knew they'd been forgiven much. They were reflecting God's grace. And the clue here is in verse 26. Because we'll get to this more later, but Noah says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." Well, that's a very odd way to put it, isn't it? Noah is blessing God. He's not saying, God bless Shem. That's what you would expect, isn't it? Rather, he's almost saying Shem blesses God. How can that be? Well, Noah sees in Shem's action God's grace. God is reflected in Shem. Which reminds us that grace isn't this sort of thing that's dispensed from heaven. It's a person. Grace is God himself. To know God's grace means to know God. Because God is someone who covers sin. And they were covering Noah. They were reflecting God's grace. But that leaves us with a bit of a problem, doesn't it? We've got this problem we keep coming up with, that God is too soft. All through Genesis, the problem is actually not God's judgment, but God's lack of judgment. You know, he even protects guilty murderer Cain. God is slow to judge. And so you have this very odd scenario here, that Noah, who sinned in a very obvious, dramatic way, there's no mention of any condemnation for him. Shem and Japheth, who cover sin rather than expose it, are blessed. And Ham, the moralist, who is absolutely right in recognizing that Noah's actions were wrong, ends up being condemned through his son, Canaan. What sort of God would overlook the sins of notorious sinners and condemn the morally upright? I mean, just what sort of God would do that? Now, let me think for a moment. That sounds rather like Jesus. We see Jesus here. As we keep finding, the God of creation is Jesus. The God of the flood is Jesus. Now, don't misunderstand me. Noah's sin is not ignored. God isn't saying this is all right. I mean, let's face it, God's recorded it for us in the most read book on the planet. I mean, more people know about Noah's sin than just about anyone else's sin in history. So there's an honesty here. But what's God going to do about it?
Shem and Japheth weren't really dealing with the problem of sin. They were simply covering it.
They couldn't be the rescuers here. So what's God going to do? You know, God's promised this era of grace. He's overlooking sin. But you can't do that forever, or else you end up condoning sin. What on earth is God's plan? And for that, we need to see the victory of grace that's revealed in this prophecy of Noah. The only time Noah speaks, the only words we have of Noah, and he's speaking here, I believe, as a prophet. He is speaking God's word. And so what Noah says here is fulfilled to some extent in events we read of in the Old Testament. But he's also looking further ahead to the coming of Jesus. And that shouldn't really surprise us, because we keep finding that in Genesis. Genesis 3:15, the promise of the seed of the woman. Who's that talking about? Jesus. So even right at the beginning, Jesus is in view. Abraham, the promise to Abraham, the blessing through Abraham, well, that's talking about Jesus. You read Jacob's prophecies about his family in Genesis 49. Again, he's talking about the future. Jesus is in view. So it's not such a strange thing to see that in these verses as well. And we'll get to that. But there's sort of three components, if you like, to this victory in grace. And we see that in these three sons. First of all, in Canaan. In Canaan, where grace is refused, and that leads to this curse. It leads to judgment. And of course, the obvious question is, why Canaan and not Ham? Ham was the one that sinned. Well, beginning of chapter 9, Ham, along with all the other sons of Noah, is blessed. And it seems in Genesis, if you've been blessed, you can't then be cursed. Secondly, we're told explicitly that Ham is Noah's youngest son. Ham has four sons. Canaan is the youngest of his sons. So if you like, Noah is shamed by his youngest son. Ham is going to be shamed by his youngest son. There's a sort of a justice to it. And I think the third reason is that Ham is the father of Canaan in character as well as in biology. Just as back in chapter 4, Jubal was the father of musicians. That's not a biological thing. It's saying that the skill of musicians is represented in Jubal. And in the same way, the character of Ham ends up being reflected in future generations, in Canaan, and in Canaan's descendants, the Canaanites. They picked up, if you like, on this lack of grace that was demonstrated by Ham. And so you get this nation of Canaanites that comes out of Canaan, who lived in the land of Israel, and who lived in the land of Canaan, I guess. And it's the Israelites, the descendants of Shem, who end up destroying them and enslaving them in the time of Joshua. This anticipates things going on in the rest of the Bible. And again, if it all starts getting a bit confusing, the key thing is read the Bible. And you keep reading the Bible, these things start to come together. And in those Canaanites, we see what happens when a society consistently rejects God's grace. If you've got a society that turns away from God's grace, what do you get? Well, the Canaanites were an incredibly violent society. And that's what you end up with when there's no grace. Because you've got to exact revenge. And then you've got to get revenge on the revenge. And you get a great cycle of death. And in that sort of society, the weak are going to suffer. You end up getting child sacrifice. It was a society of extreme sexual perversion as well. God gave sex as a gift that was meant to actually be about grace, about giving. If you reject grace, it becomes about power, exploitation, slavery. It's no accident that Canaan here is talked of as a slave, because
He's become a slave literally in certain respects to Israel later on. But there's lots of other ways he's a slave as well.
Because rejecting grace always leads to slavery. We lose freedom when we turn away from God.
Great message of the New Testament, message of Galatians,
is that going down the path of moral self-righteousness, rejecting grace, is actually a path of slavery and death. And you see that with the Canaanites as well. And understand, with the Canaanites, the problem was not their ethnicity, their nationality. The problem was their rejection of grace. It wasn't that they're so desperate to turn to God. We would so love to serve him and to love him, but we can't because we've been cursed. They weren't saying that. They'd made a choice. They had no interest in following God. And God waited hundreds of years. God covered their sin for hundreds of years before issuing that command for them to be destroyed. And yet even then, grace wins. Rahab turns to God. She shows how they could turn to God if they wanted to. And later on in the Bible, it's a Canaanite woman that comes to us to find grace. Grace wins, even in the Canaanites. And it's only one of Ham's children that is cursed. God is very limited, if you like, in this curse. And the Canaanites only end up being destroyed so that Israel would be preserved. Why does that matter? Because it's in Israel that grace for all mankind would come. That's what we see in Shem. In Shem, if you like, is the location of grace, where grace is found. Shem is given this place of honour in this blessing by God, by Noah. Why Shem and not Japheth? They both did the same thing. Well, it's God's choice. It's God's grace. He was no better than Japheth. That's the whole point about grace. It's not earned. And as we read on in the history, many in Shem's line actually rejected grace. They became like the Canaanites. But the blessing that comes here through Shem is from the God of Shem. Because the God of Shem becomes the descendant of Shem. Jesus is born in Shem's line. Jesus is an Israelite. That matters. Because he is the one that will come to cover sin. Grace is found in a particular person. There's something very narrow, if you like, about it in that sense. And yet, it's a gift for all. Because grace is about giving. And the grace of Shem is shared. If you don't share grace, you haven't understood grace. Grace is shared widely. And that's what we see in Japheth. Japheth is wrapped in... Japheth means enlarge. There's a bit of a play on words here, because it's Japheth's descendants that spread more across the world. They are like the Gentiles, spread across the world. And yet we're told here that may Japheth live in the tents of Shem. They're spread out and yet they live in the tents of Shem. How can that be? Well, what does it mean to be in someone's tent? It means you're covered. It means you're at home. It means, really, you're part of the family. So I think this is looking ahead to the time when the Gentiles, when all nations share in the blessing that comes through Shem, the blessing, the grace that is found in Jesus Christ. There's hints of that throughout the Old Testament where different ones of these nations come and find grace in God. But it's fulfilled actually in our era, in our time. These verses that seem so remote, you know, may God extend the territory of Japheth, may Japheth live in the tents of Shem. You think, what's all that about? Well, it's here in front of us. It's here in this church. Because grace is found in the tents of Shem. It's found in Jesus Christ. So whatever nationality you are, we find grace in the tents of Shem. We're wrapped in grace. What a fulfillment. what God has done. He spread this grace widely. There's a victory of grace in this world. So just understand finally that Jesus truly covers sin. Beginning of John's Gospel, it says that Jesus came and literally pitched his tent among us. He was going to spread his tent over his people. Jesus came to cover sin. Isn't it amazing how he welcomed those who realized that they were sinners? He didn't go on about their wrong. He covered their sin. And he went to the cross so that all those sins, including Noah, that had been overlooked for millennia, dealt with. That God wasn't stopping justice. God was going to deal with sin. But he was waiting, he was covering it, he was being patient until Jesus came. So there can be real forgiveness. There is real covering of sin. Such that our sins, when we trust Christ, are never remembered against us anymore. Micah puts it that they are hurled into the depths of the sea. And it's as if God puts up a sign saying, no fishing. They are gone. Because Jesus has truly paid the price. This is the blessing of, we read at the beginning of the service, Psalm 32, the blessing of God covering sin. And Jesus does it by being the opposite of Noah. Noah avoided responsibility. Jesus took responsibility. Took responsibility for evil that was not even his. He took responsibility for our sin. And at the cross, he refused to drink wine. Before he ended up being naked on the cross. Very opposite of Noah. And on the cross you actually see sin displayed, not covered. You see sin in its full horror because you see the Son of God, the perfect Son of God, crucified. But it's because of that. When you trust in Christ, he covers you with his righteousness, so that you can be perfect in his sight, so that you can be prepared for paradise. Paradise isn't found by looking back to Eden. It's not found by trying to work our way back to perfection. You can't. That gate is closed. Paradise is found in Jesus. And we look ahead. Don't look back. We look ahead to his return, when there will be a final new creation that the flood points to. A final victory over sin, where it will be complete. So the grace you need this morning is found in Jesus. It's in him alone. Let him cover you.